From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump on Friday announced airstrikes against Syrian government targets in retaliation for a recent chemical attack against civilians in Douma. A U.S. military general, Joseph Dunford, explained exactly what the U.S. and its European allies hit.
At 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, French, British, and U.S. forces struck targets in Syria in support of President Trump's objective to deter the future use of chemical weapons. Our forces were integrated throughout the planning and execution of the operation. The targets that were struck and destroyed were specifically associated with the Syrian regime's chemical weapons program. We also selected targets that would minimize the risk to innocent civilians. The first target was a scientific research center located in the greater Damascus area. This military facility was a Syrian center for the research, development, production, and testing of chemical and biological warfare technology. The second target was a chemical weapons storage facility west of Homs. We assessed that this was the primary location of Syrian sarin and precursor production equipment. The third target, which was in the vicinity of the second target, contained both a chemical weapons equipment storage facility and an important command post.
General Joseph Dunford explaining the three targets in Syria that the U.S. and its allies hit. After the airstrikes, Trump tweeted, "Mission accomplished." Meanwhile, inspectors by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons arrived in Syria on Saturday after being assured by the Syrian government that they would be allowed to inspect the sites of the chemical attack in Douma. But by Monday morning, they were apparently not being given access. My guest is Robin Yassin Kassab. He's the author with Leila Al-Shami of the book Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. His earlier book and novel is called The Road from Damascus. He's written about Syria and The Guardian, The National Foreign Policy, The Daily Beast, Newsweek, and Al Jazeera. He's also co-editor and regular contributor to Pulse. Welcome to the program, Robin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So first, before we get into the details of what exactly the Trump administration's goals are and what it hit, I feel like we need to set the stage for the fact that the U.S. has been bombing Syria, right? People have been getting very upset about, or the U.S. has launched attacks on Syria. But it seems as though the only major thing that was different with these strikes was that the Trump administration made a big deal about it and that the targets were different, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. A lot of people have suddenly realized that something's happening in Syria, and some people are going out on protests and saying, you know, don't start a war in Syria. Unbeknownst to them, there's been some form of war going on in Syria for 7 years now. The Russians have been terror bombing since 2015. There's all kinds of other external interventions. The Americans have been there since late 2014 as part of their war on terror, their so-called war on terror. They're just seeing it myopically through the lens of this. And they've, you know, they've, in the name of fighting ISIS, and they have driven ISIS back, and that's a good thing. You know, the vast majority of Syrians hate ISIS as much as they hate Assad. Nevertheless, in the way in which they've done it, you know, the city of Raqqa, for example, has been absolutely, totally destroyed, and thousands of civilians have been killed. And we didn't see demonstrations then. We didn't even see kind of considered calls for maybe President Trump should order the rules of engagement to be tightened up. So if there are if there's a danger of hitting, you know, people, civilians, then they don't do it. But we haven't heard a fuss about this. There's not much awareness of how the West is already involved in Syria, and also what else is happening in Syria, because 94% of the, that was by late 2017, it may have changed slightly since then, 94% of registered, named, documented civilian deaths were caused by the Assad regime and its allies, the Russians and the Iranians. So before we even look at what the whole thing is about, we know that the biggest killer there is Assad and Russia and Iran, the biggest, therefore the biggest source of instability, the biggest force driving people out of the country and creating a vacuum in which all kinds of mad foreigners, including ISIS, can come in. And all of this is not really considered by people who think that because Trump bombed some probably empty chemical weapons sites the other day, that suddenly something started in Syria. It's been going on for a long time.
Right.
I have lived in Syria. I've got immediate family in Syria, and Syria is an important part of my life. But I'm not a Syrian in the sense that, you know, I have a British passport, and I'm in Scotland, and I am able to eat and to express my opinion without anybody shooting at me. I haven't been tortured. Millions of people have no other passport and no other opportunities other than inside Syria, which is being made impossible for them at the moment.
So when Trump announced these attacks, what do you think the goal of these attacks was? Because before these attacks, the U.S.'s stated goal in bombing Syria was to attack ISIS. ISIS is now in retreat, and Trump, of course, is claiming credit for that. Now what? Is the U.S. actually putting out strikes or targeting strikes against Assad's strongholds because Trump wants to actually overthrow the Assad government?
No, of course not. Where the context in which these strikes came was the context of chemical weapons use. And to understand what's happened, we have to go back to 2012, when Assad, in 2011, of course, if we were really going to talk about how it all started, there was a popular uprising against the Assad regime. And it was at first non-violent, non-sectarian, people from all backgrounds, unarmed protesters in the streets being gunned down month after month after month. And then it militarized. And as, army defectors and local men picked up weapons first just to defend their own communities, Assad, started really using full-scale military force against civilian areas. He started using, and this is before ISIS and so on, he started using helicopter gunships and aerial bombardment, barrel bombs, artillery tanks against civilians. At this point, President Obama said, okay, concerning Syria, if I see chemical weapons being used, that will be a red line, and that will change my calculation. And at the time, a lot of Syrians were upset because they thought, well, this is just giving the guy open permission to keep killing any way he likes so long as he doesn't use chemical weapons. But what happened was almost a year exactly after Obama said that, in August 2013, Assad did use sarin gas. There was a mass sarin gas attack on the eastern Ghouta, actually, the suburbs of eastern Damascus, and about 1,400 people were killed in a few hours. And what happened next? Obama did nothing. So the red line disappeared. And in the following 2 years, what happened was that Assad understood from that, okay, the red line has become a green light. The rate of killing, the number of casualties doubled from, the rate doubled after that from what it was in the 2 years before, and ISIS appeared, and so many Syrian rebels started saying, we have no faith that anybody in the West wants to support us. This is an existential fight. We have to start appealing to rich Muslim donors in the Gulf and so on, because no one else is going to help us. And it contributed to the Islamization of the problem. When Trump came in, Assad used sarin gas again at Khan Sheikhoun in 2017, about a year ago. And at that point, Trump wanted to show that, Trump had arrived and Obama was gone and Trump was a strong man. There was a sheriff back in town. And he did what turned out to be a symbolic gestural strike. He hit the airfield from which the chemical weapons attack had been launched. And he warned Putin an hour before, so they were able to move, quite a lot of equipment, but he did hit some planes and he cratered the airfield. The airfield was back in use a couple of days later. Trump thought that he'd made his point. He'd shown that he was going to have this chemical weapons red line and be different, and he'd invested his word in this and so on. So he did that. In the year that followed, the Assad regime used chlorine gas many times, but chlorine rarely actually kills people. It's very, very unpleasant, and it makes people panic, and it can disable fighters, but it rarely kills people. It has killed some babies and infants. Those attacks are not generally noticed. But this last attack in Douma was a mass casualty attack. It wasn't half as big as previous attacks, but it was a mass casualty attack. So,
and I want to get to that chemical attack in just a minute. But when Trump declared on his Twitter feed, mission accomplished, as far as you know, what was he talking about? What mission did he accomplish?
Well, this is it. He accomplished making a gesture to show that he was a tough guy, maybe. But no other mission has been accomplished. It's almost certain that you haven't stopped Assad's ability to make and use chemical weapons by hitting those three strikes after there was a week of warning. It's very unlikely that you've actually taught Assad or anybody else in the world that using even just chemical weapons is a bad idea, because it's a net win for Assad. He, in order to, you know, by doing this last attack, he made Jaish al-Islam, the largest militia in Douma, capitulate, surrender. If his forces had had to fight their way into Douma, they would have lost thousands more loyalist men, and he doesn't have many Syrian troops.
Right, and in fact, Reuters announced just that. Reuters just put out a piece in the last couple of days, actually on Monday, saying Syria attack triggered Western action, but on the ground, Assad gained. And it pointed out that under pressure from beleaguered residents and facing Russian threats of further such attacks, the rebel group Jaish al-Islam finally agreed to surrender Douma and leave for the Turkish border. This is interesting because this is exactly what, this is a very concrete win for Assad as a result of the attack. But sadly, on the left here in the United States, and I believe in the UK as well, we're hearing a lot of people saying, there's no way Assad was responsible for this chemical attack because he had nothing to gain. But clearly he did have something to gain, and he gained it.
And he won from it. And every time he's used chemical weapons, it's been, strategically on the ground, it's worked in his favor. And also strategically, internationally and politically, it's worked in his favor because he's been able to show his constituency, and Russia and Iran have been able to show theirs, look, our policy is working, because even if sometimes they complain and cry, they don't actually give a damn. They'll hit something symbolically. We can weather that. We suffer worse all the time, and we'll get on with business as usual. So the actual policy in Syria with regard to the West is not regime change. It's appeasement, or perhaps collaboration. There's no evidence that the United States or that the West or that the Europeans have seriously tried to get rid of Assad. You know, it wasn't them that started this. They have at times, especially, you know, the United States has on and off, and now since Trump came in, it's stopped completely. They have on and off armed various free army groups in a small way at times, and then stopped again for political reasons, to make gestures to other powers, or in the context of the war on ISIS. But they haven't, you know, Obama vetoed anti-aircraft weapons getting in, which is the one defensive weapon that the people really needed that would have made a difference. I'm not talking about weapons to go and capture Assad's palace or his hometown where he has supporters. I'm talking about weapons to defend urban areas which have been liberated and which are being ruled by democratic self-organized councils, to try and defend those from daily attack from the air on schools and hospitals and marketplaces. Instead, he vetoed that. He did a deal with Iran, despite, you know, the rhetoric. He did a deal with Iran over the nuclear thing and the sanctions, which in itself I don't have a problem with. But in order to get that deal, he completely ignored the fact that Iran was pouring in tens of thousands of Shia jihadist militiamen from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Lebanon into Syria on behalf of the dictator. That in itself is a big cause of the Sunni backlash and helps groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, who are Sunni Muslim extremists. When they see foreign Shia extremists coming in, they say, look, join us. It's not about democracy and freedom. It's about those people hate us because we're Sunnis, you know. So it was very destructive. Obama ignored it, didn't say anything about it. Trump comes in and talks big about Iran, but he's actually not doing anything to roll back Iran in Syria, which is where it's most destabilizing. Nobody cares about the Syrian people. Nobody is taking into account the fact that there is a daily extermination. And people are making up conspiracy theories and so on, and it's not really happening. And
maybe he didn't actually
gas people because he's winning the war, which people have said every single time he's gassed people. I remember them saying that in 2013.
Right, that somehow the rebel groups are gassing themselves or gassing the people around them. Let's briefly talk about that, because unfortunately, even as a result of this interview, I know I'll get a bunch of emails from folks who are upset because they feel that just as having this conversation is a green light for war and genocide of Syrians, even though, of course, Syrians are being killed on a daily basis, primarily by Assad with Russia and Iran's help. But I looked through some of these claims that the only videos of the attack were from Al-Qaeda sources. The New York Times did a really extensive investigation on April 11th entitled, "In a Syrian Town, People Started Shouting, Chemicals, Chemicals." And I just want to quote what the Times said. It said, "While much about the attack remains unclear, a New York Times review of more than 20 videos of its aftermath, an examination of flight records compiled by citizen observers, and interviews with a dozen residents, medics, and rescue workers suggest that during a military push to break the will of Duma's rebels, pro-government forces dropped charges bearing some kind of chemical compound that suffocated at least 43 people and left many more struggling to breathe." I can't imagine the New York Times, flawed as it is in many ways, would be part of some grand conspiracy to implicate Assad.
Well, I was following through the people in Duma uploading stuff, and people that I've been following for years, and there were dozens of, you know, added together videos, photographs, oral reports, written accounts of what was happening. And this comes in a context after the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and the UN has found Assad guilty on 34 occasions, definitely, of using chemical weapons against his people. There's also absolutely no doubt about the fact that every day he's using barrel bombs and artillery and so on civilian targets, not as part of any war. You can take a position on which rebel groups you like or don't like or how dangerous they are or whatever, but we're not talking about a war between armies. We're talking about Assad hitting the civilians in order to drive them out so that the rebels have got no society in which to live in, so they have to go to, so that he can come and take over with his foreign troops and foreign bombers. There's imperialism going on here of the most savage and disgusting kind on the Russian side. And it's being ignored.
But unfortunately, the anti-imperialist forces in the Western left seem to think that only the West has imperial ambitions. And we saw over the weekend a number of protests, which we don't see protests in defense of the Syrian people when Assad is attacking them. But when the West attacks Assad, we unfortunately see people showing up with signs that shockingly support the dictator of Syria, a man who inherited his position and who has remained in power undemocratically for years. And it blows my mind. I'm sure for you, it's even more disheartening as a Syrian to see how people do this.
I think, you know, there's two points here. One point is the problem that the left has, of course, the right as well, but I'm not talking about the right because I kind of expect.
Right.
expect them not to have a people-focused perspective necessarily. Maybe that's unfair, and there's all kinds of rightists, but that what I would expect. And I would have expected, I don't anymore, but I think that says something about what I've learned and a lot about the state of the left today in the West particularly, but all over the world. I think the left has failed to come to terms with the problem of states. Now, what do I mean by that? When people get really, really upset when no civilians are killed, but some empty military sites are hit, state military sites, but they don't get upset when, you know, in March this year, I believe about 1,000 civilians were killed by American bombing in the war against ISIS, and there wasn't a protest about that. Now, before we go into the Syrian revolution and what Russia's doing and so on, just if we're limiting it to what America's doing, why are they upset about a fascist, unrepresentative fascist state military sites being bombed, but not about poor civilians, you know, in their hundreds and thousands, women and children, being blown to pieces, blown to, you know, ripped to bits by weapons? Because the focus is on states. And it's true that in international law, states have sovereignty, but I would argue that international, we should be a bit more progressive than international law, which was made by states. I think people have sovereignty, not states. We should worry about people, and we should also be internationalist. And this brings me on to my next point, which is about racism. That I think most people on the left, if they call themselves leftists, it almost goes without saying that they would consider themselves to be anti-racists, that they recognize that racism and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and all kinds of prejudice are actually parts of the unjust economic and social system that we're trying to improve in some way, or trying to resist in some way. So they couldn't imagine that they're racists. But the fact that in Syria, dozens or hundreds of people reported, Syrians of all kinds, you know, some of them Islamists, some of them leftists, some of them nationalists, some of them completely apolitical, men and women, you know, Muslims and Christians and so on, all of them were reporting this chemical attack. And yet all of that can be wiped aside. We can ignore that because we've read something on a conspiracy theory that was fed into our internet sphere by the Kremlin, you know. So that fits
within the worldview, right? Because people believe things that fit within their worldview rather than facts, unfortunately.
Here in Britain, the so-called opposition party, you know, which is at the moment considered to be fairly radically left and progressive and so on, and in my opinion, really isn't at all, the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. You know, Diane Abbott, who's one of his front bench people, one of his important would-be a minister if he was in government, keeps saying that the opposition to Assad is all ragtag jihadis. And this is where this kind of thing comes from, the White Helmets conspiracy theories, that the White Helmets are a front for Al-Qaeda. You know, these ordinary civilian men and women who have decided instead of picking up arms, what they're going to do in their neighborhood is they're going to be civil defense and go in at huge danger to their own life. And they get deliberately targeted as well. They're going to go into buildings and pull out people who are from the wreckage. That this is in somehow an Al-Qaeda front. They've received some money from USAID and probably from the EU and so on. And the USAID also, I mean, all the schools in occupied Palestine, in the West Bank, the education system would probably collapse if it wasn't from aid from USAID and others. That doesn't mean that people in the West Bank in Palestine are minions
of
the
US,
United
right,
States,
yeah.
are pawns of international imperialism. And if people are, of course, people on the ground in Syria trying to rescue people from the wreckage, trying to do emergency medical care in the middle of a genocide, of a disaster, are going to ask European governments, Western governments, the Japanese, anyone that might donate some charity money to help them do that work. But if you choose to build a huge big conspiracy theory out of this, it's because you want to. And people should ask themselves about this. You know, if you still believe this stuff after 7 years in Syria, first ask yourself, have you engaged closely enough? Have you really looked at what's happening there? And if you think you have, then I would say that you are deluded because you want to be deluded. And this says something about deep structures of racism in our society. When you can, and it's so selective, because leftists, rightly, when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, and an insurgency developed against the Americans, leftists in the West refused to see this in terms of a war on terror. When George Bush said, "We're fighting terrorists," they said, "Look, some of these people may have unpleasant ideas, but basically what they're responding to is your foreign occupation. So we're not going to take on board this war on terror rhetoric." When Palestinians resist Israel, we recognize, we know that there is a huge range of opinion in Palestinian society that opposes Israel and believes in resisting Israel, from hardcore jihadists through the Salafists and the Sufis to democratic Islamists to secularists to leftists and so on. Exactly the same in Syria. In Syria, there were hundreds, I don't know how many are left, they're still working in liberated areas, but the liberated areas have shrunk so much in the last years because they've been hit so hard. But at one point, there were over 700 democratic or quasi-democratic, it depended on the area and the system, self-organized local councils in the liberated areas, in areas liberated from both ISIS and the Assad regime. There were women's centers, and there still are in the places that survive, women's centers. You don't hear about this. Women's centers which were centers for organized by women, for women to come and like learn skills, to encourage economic and social participation, and so on. There were free media. There was a free debate going on. All of this has been ignored in favor of the idea that, first, this is a proxy thing, entirely a proxy thing. And people went out to demonstrate because in some way they were tricked or bribed by the CIA or Mossad. I mean, Syrians are not stupid children. They don't need clever white people to come and tell them, excuse me.
Right.
To come and tell them that they should be upset about having their children tortured to death, or about having no economic future, or about, you know, the total corruption they see every day. Syrians know the situation in Syria better than non-Syrians. And in 2011, millions of Syrians, on some Fridays, millions were on the streets, despite the fact that they knew that they were facing gunfire. And Assad declared war on them.
Right.
And it's out of this war that, yes, it has become terribly complicated, and lots of other horrible things have come in. ISIS is in some ways even worse than Assad. They don't kill as many because they haven't had the means. You know, there's a war now between Kurds and Turks in Syria. There's kind of a war between Iran and Israel in Syria, and that's liable to flare up at any moment. There are all kinds of nasty groups in Syria, authoritarians and so on. All of this came out of the mess of the Assad regime declaring war on his people when they asked for social justice and freedom, not for an Islamic State or anything like that. This story has been ignored. And then, yes, foreign imperialists in the West played games. They kind of stopped the rebels. They basically stopped it succeeding. They stopped the rebels getting what they needed, at least to protect their areas so they could build a serious alternative. They sat and watched as Islamists came in and jihadists came in from all over the world. Then they went in to destroy cities entirely, the West, in the name of the war on terror, but just left the guy Assad alone and kind of invited Iran and Russia in, and now they're saying, well, we can't do much because it's Iran and Russia's business. Meanwhile, this thing is still escalating. Just because Trump is now going to go back to sleep or worrying about his many other scandals doesn't mean that every day in Syria people are going to continue to die. And every day hundreds more will be leaving their homes. And this is a recipe for endless war, endless conflict, into which, of course, the United States will repeatedly get drawn in.
Right. Robin, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Certainly recommend your book, Burning Country, that we'd had you on a little over a year ago to discuss, and that interview's on our website. The book, of course, available in bookstores. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you.
Robin Yassin Kassab is author with Leila Al-Shami of the book Burning Country, Syrians in Revolution and War. He has written about Syria in The Guardian, The National, Foreign Policy, The Daily Beast, Newsweek, and Al Jazeera. He's also a co-editor and regular contributor to Pulse, and we've been discussing the latest U.S. strikes on Syria and much more. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. Thank you.